Blog Talk Radio.
Not good, we'll do it live. Yay.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and I.
Good morning, everyone. This is MJ Network, and we are live, and I'm your host, Fran Lewis, and we are going to spotlight Imposter's Law with one and only New York Times author, Carla Negus, one of my favorite authors and one of my favorite books. So this is going to be fun. If you have any questions on my Facebook wall, feel free to ask away. Good morning. How you doing, and how is it by you? Because it's freezing here.
I'm up on my hilltop in Vermont, and I'm very happy. It's chilly, but the sun's out. So,
oh, well,
that's
at least
good.
You have that. I'm trying to see. It's 41 degrees, and it's freezing outside, and the wind chill is whatever. And tomorrow, they're expecting a nor'easter. Other than that, we're doing great.
Okay. I know. It's like we catch these couple of days of sun between the storms. It's been kind of a stormy pattern, it feels like, anyway. But all is well, you know. You think about the people down in the Florida Panhandle recovering from the hurricane there, and you know we can handle it.
It's horrible. And then the bomb threats, and the bombs this morning, the package bombs and the pipe bombs this morning in New York was horrible. It's horrible.
Yeah.
So we've got the Donovans and the Sharps. Tell everybody how you created them. Give them a little bit of a backstory, because we want them to be able to start from the beginning and read every single one of the books.
Okay. Well, Imposter's Lure is the latest installment of my Sharp and Donovan series. And I try to make each book stand on its own, and yet there are arcs involving various characters. And at the heart of the series are FBI agents Emma Sharp, an art crimes expert, and Colin Donovan, a deep cover agent. They both, turns out, they didn't know each other growing up, but they're both from southern Maine, but very different worlds, these little towns in southern Maine. And the Sharps are a family of private art detectives. Wendell Sharp, Emma's grandfather, he was a museum guard, and he started his own art detective business, Sharp Fine Art Recovery, in his little hometown in Maine. But he was actually born in Ireland, so now, long story, but he ends up in Dublin. But the company is the Sharp Fine Art Recovery is run by Emma's brother, Lucas, and she is an FBI agent right now. So, and then we have the Donovans, who are just up the coast a little bit in this fishing village of Rock Point, and they're cops and lobstermen from a very different world from what Emma knows. And yet Emma and Colin have just bonded. They go on these adventures together, investigate different kinds of crimes and Imposter's Lure. They're newlyweds by now, and they are about to investigate a missing prosecutor.
Yeah, I know. That was scary. How did Emma become an FBI, and explain HIT? Who runs it and how? Why did she become – she was a nun, wasn't she?
She took this little detour in her life and became a postulant and a novice at the Sisters of the Joyful Heart and this little isolated peninsula on the Maine coast. And she studied art history, so it was while she was in college. And she was about to take her final vows when – Matt Yankowski, this FBI agent, senior agent, arrived at her convent and talked to her, and she knew it just really, it was a diversion. She learned a lot during that time at the convent and just figured out a lot of stuff about herself and what she wanted. And she ended up going to work for her grandfather for a little while with the family company, But then joined the FBI, and Matt wanted her, Yank we call him, wanted her to be in the FBI. He thought that her unusual background as a art crimes expert, an art conservationist, even her time, the short time in the convent, and then as a sharp would benefit the FBI. And then he created about, so Imposter's Lure takes place in the summer, so the not the first March, but like a year ago, this latest March, and he started this, got her to come to this HIT, he calls it. It's High Impact Target. It's a special unit, small unit that he's kind of put on its own in offices in Boston. And of course, they're tied. They're totally in with the FBI, but they work. They really focus exclusively on these elusive, highly resourced criminals and criminal networks. And so and she does the art crimes component of that. And art crimes just has different tentacles into other crimes. It's smuggling, money laundering, all kinds of different things, as well as the art crimes itself, like forgery and art theft.
You have to be really good to tell the difference between real and fake, too. That's what's really amazing.
Yes, it's been something I've been learning a lot about as I've been writing the Sharp and Donovan series. And because you can have something that's a copy, it's like it's a known. It's not really a fake because nobody's trying to pretend it's anything else. Like if you sit down and decide you're going to copy the Mona Lisa, it's obviously not Da Vinci, and it's intentionally a copy. You don't sign it, or you're just learning about the processes that Da Vinci might have used, and so it's above board. Some people just have stuff copied because they just want it. You know, they just like to learn about it as artists, as painters, or they want to do a copy of a work. And then there's the ones that are actual forgeries. Of original works, of they take that work and make a fake one, or they use the painter, like they'll do a fake Rembrandt, and it's not a copy of any of the Rembrandts. It's not an exact rendition, but it looks like his work, and they fake it, try to pass it off as his work.
I wonder sometimes if people actually think they're getting a real one. And I wonder if these forgeries ever really look so real that no one can really tell. There's got to be a way, I'm sure, that they can tell the difference.
Yeah, there have been some very amazing cases of that, including pieces in museums that the museum didn't realize was actually not an authentic work. But they're, the techniques of recognizing inauthentic works has definitely improved. And it's a fascinating, fascinating subject. There's all kinds of books on it and articles, and it's a fun thing just to dive in and read. Amazing, the different technologies and the different just art detection, where you take a piece and you try to figure out, like, for instance, you can look at the kind of paint that was used. Did that even exist back then? Back when the original, we'll do Rembrandt. Did this particular paint exist when he was alive? Did this, the backing, the canvases, all the different materials that are used, that's just one technique that's used. So it's a fascinating area, and there's real experts out there who are pursuing it.
I often wonder, too, because, you go to museums. I love museums. And I'm pretty good with telling fake stones from real ones. And you often wonder, my mother, she was guilty of this, seriously. And I can sort of tell. It's like really, especially sapphires, which is my birthstone. And I mean, I wonder sometimes in the museum, is that real? Are those really millions of dollars behind there, or is it fake because they're afraid someone's going to bust the glass open and steal it? You know, you wonder because in some of these rooms, there's no guards. And I'm going like, I don't think anybody wants to find out. But, I had gone to a flea market once, and I looked at this ring, and I'm saying, the lady said to me, it's $6. I said, I'll give you $5. I went to another booth to find out the ring was worth a couple of hundred because it was topaz, and I knew it. It's like, not bad. Yeah,
that's not bad.
Not bad at all. I mean, there was another case where, you know, I went, and it was a red stone, and I go, okay, it's a dollar. It turned out to be a ruby. They didn't know it was in a junk box, and I'm saying, like, oh, my God, how could they not know? I don't know why I knew it. Well, tell me, you started this novel in a very unique way with Verity Blackwood. I felt so bad for her. How did you create, why did you create that? And then there's a voice in her head that says, no one's going to hear me, and she just wants to sleep. How did you create that at the beginning? And why doesn't any, why does anybody want to hurt her? She's so sweet. Not really.
Verity Blackwood is, we meet her in this, you know, the opening pages of Imposter's Lure, and we're in her point of view, and she's struggling. Something's happened to her, and she doesn't know what it is, and she's just going down this hole of being drugged or whatever is happening to her, and that it just felt right when I was writing the book that this was part of this puzzle that Imposter's Lure is. And this is one piece of the puzzle, and it's dramatic. It's a strong, triggering event in many ways, and yet is anybody going to find her? Is she going to be okay? And we go right from that to Emma in Boston, Emma Sharp, our FBI agent, and she's trying to have like a normal Sunday afternoon. She's cleaning their apartment. Colin is off with his brothers at their annual annual Red Sox game, and so she didn't want to go. She just like she's doing her thing, and here comes this prosecutor, and it's kind of a weird meeting. So that's another piece of this puzzle. It's like what's going on. And what's her connection to Verity in those opening pages?
So tell us, we were talking about Sharp Art Recovery. So tell us about Tamara McDermott and why her daughter is upset with her because they had this birthday party for her. And, you know, knowing, you know, that parents sometimes don't make birthday parties or somebody gets sick, I felt so bad for her, but she was angry, but she had every right to be, or at least she thought she did, but we don't know that.
Well, Adeline and Tamara, the mother and daughter, and Tamara's gone. She's a hard-driving prosecutor. She's very committed to her work, and she has her only daughter. But she also recently got divorced, and her daughter now is turning 21, and mom's come to Boston where her daughter's studying. And so she's in college, her last years in college, and they're going to have this birthday celebration. But something happens, and Alan doesn't know what it is, and her mother doesn't show up. And her first thing is, like, here's her mother just being selfish again, just blowing it off, just doing something, going on vacation early, rather than worrying about her initially. She just assumes that she's just in a bad place as a daughter and she loves her mother and yet just like very frustrated because this is her time. I mean, her mother's missed birthdays before and here's their chance to really celebrate and she doesn't show up. Whereas Emma and Colin look at that and go, okay, wait, something's going on here. And they try to figure out, did the mother just like blow off the birthday party, the birthday dinner that she arranged, and invited Emma and Colin too, and Matt Yankowski. They're old friends. Tamara and Matt Yankowski are old friends. And so it's just one of those things that's like there's a lot of emotion and baggage in the relationship, the mother-daughter relationship here, that has to be sorted out so we can understand what's going on. And it does look like Tamara just went on her vacation. She stopped in Boston for this birthday celebration and then was going to go on a real vacation. She was just kind of burned out and just needed a break. but she leaves early, and she had that funny meeting with Emma earlier in the day, inviting him to dinner, and doesn't show up for dinner, and so it looks, you know, wonky. She's got to figure it out.
I know, she got me angry. I can understand where she's coming from, because, you know, parents need to be more concerned, but, you know, Adeline has a reason, and we're not going to tell you why. You're going to have to read the book to find out.
Yeah, and she's got some issues. She's sorting through of that. She's just turning 21, and sometimes
you have
issues when you're...
I wasn't allowed to have issues ever. No, really.
My
mother told me what my issues were. A's in school, and don't go out until you're 21. I wasn't allowed to date till I was 21, and I had to have a chaperone.
Oh, really?
Oh, she was very strict. Obviously, she was smart. I should have listened to her when I was older, too.
Well,
seriously,
that's often what we say as we go along, huh? You know?
Yeah, she used to do some strange things anyway. My mother, she's a trip. So we have Jolie Romero, and why do we get an odd sense about her? I wasn't crazy about her at all.
I know. Jolie was, she's an art conservationist in the Boston area, and...
Mm-hmm.
And she has taken on Adeline as her, basically like an intern to work with her, and Adeline's been studying document preservation. It's a fascinating,
mm-hmm.
another fascinating topic. And so Jolie has a relationship with Emma's former convent, which specialized in art conservation, and Jolie is private and does her own thing just on her own, and she's tied in with different artists in the area, her clients, and one of them is this Fletcher Campbell, who is a I think of him as kind of like an Andrew Wyeth sort of artist, an American artist, and very, very well known, maybe not at Wyeth level, but still really well known, and there's a whole relationship that goes on with that and with Adeline and Fletcher's grandson Rex, and it's just that's where we get a sense of, you know, that maybe Jolie is really doing some things that might be inappropriate or might be unethical, but we don't know, but there's sort of a sense of that going on, and what was her, is she being straight about her dealings with Tamara McDermott, our missing prosecutor.
No one is straight with anyone ever again. No.
It's these different puzzle pieces. It's in some ways it's like the story is almost like a Sudoku puzzle, you know, where you get all these things and they all fit together, but you're given like, you just got to, it's like all these exciting things going on and you're pushed forward in the story. But there's different pieces of the puzzle, and that's what makes the suspense and the mystery, and it's a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to write. I just really, really enjoyed it. I got into the characters. I found Jolie just fascinating. I found Fletcher and Ophelia Campbell, even though Ophelia has died by the time the book starts, and Fletcher now has Alzheimer's, and what that does, how Rex is stuck, you know, dealing with the estate not really being prepared for it. He's just not, he's a young guy. He's always had everything kind of handed to him and he's not really fully prepared for it. And Adeline is sympathetic to him. And they sort of bond in a way. So you have all these different characters going on and Emma and Colin diving into the middle of this and trying to figure out, okay, where's Tamara? Where's this missing prosecutor? And does this have anything to do with this famous artist and the tragedy of that, his background, and what's going on with him. And then, here comes Verity and finding out that Verity, who we opened the book with, Verity Blackwood and Graham Blackwood were in Boston. And now she's near death in London from an opiate overdose.
Opiates are bad, let me tell you.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Yes.
There's a whole big thing on the news now that doctors are not supposed to give refills for opiates or anything like that. I did a whole bunch of shows on that, too, because they're dangerous and people don't realize it. And once you take one and you like it, you might get addicted to it. So it's a wise decision to not do that and read this book and find out why.
Limit and do. Yeah, doctors, I think, are certainly being more careful. I've certainly seen that in my own family.
And I've seen it, you know, it's funny because you go to the ER once in a while, whatever, and they don't even hesitate to give it to you. That's like the first thing they say, well, would you like this, that? They give you like a menu. Which one would you like? And if you say, I don't want any, they look at you as if you're strange. You know, I'll take a Motrin or a Tylenol. And they're like, you're kidding me. It's very free. Yeah, what can I say? I mean, you have it. You tell me what the side effects are? No, thank you. So
yeah,
this part of the story I love. I love Lucy. That's Matt's wife. I love Lucy. And how come Adelaine, you know, how come she, bonds with her? And why is knitting, that's not adding, Tamara, right? Why does she bond with Lucy? And why is knitting so calming? I love knitting. I used to anyway as a kid. Why is knitting so important? And what is it, what did you bring that in? Because I love that. For those people
Lucy.
That get nervous, it's great. Lucy's great.
Yeah, by the time we get to Imposter's Lure, Lucy has opened a knitting shop in Boston, and she's a clinical psychologist who did not want to move from her home in Northern Virginia with Matt to Boston when he started this elite FBI unit. And their marriage was on the rocks, and she wasn't sure she was going to do that. But in doing it, making that break from Northern Virginia and her work as a clinical psychologist to Boston, she decided to change her life and open a knitting shop. And there's something, and it's an adorable, you know, those shops where you go in and you just, oh my gosh, you just want to sit down and knit. You want to touch the yarn. Everything's just the colors, the atmosphere, the warmth. And she's created that. And she's very different from Tamara in Adeline's eyes, from her mother, who's lawyer, this prosecutor, this she's very dedicated, and she's very proud of her mother and appreciates her dedication to her work. But Lucy strikes her as, you know, more of the warm, fuzzy type. And yet Lucy is, you know, she's a professional, and she's wants to make this business work. But for some reason, Adeline just maybe kind of projects some things onto her, and they do bond, and they have known each other on and off since Adeline was a child. So as things happen in the story and her situation becomes more volatile, she's more worried about her mother, that Lucy is someone she can turn to. And she's a little nervous about going to Yank, Matt, the husband, who's the FBI agent.
Well, eventually they figure out that Tamara is missing, eventually. But we meet Rex. I didn't like him at all. Rex is clever. He's smart. But he has to care for his father because he has Alzheimer's, you said. And as somebody that had to deal with her mother for 8 years with Alzheimer's, how come you included that? And that is the hardest thing, let me tell you, in the world, to watch somebody's brain disappear. I mean, really, it's horrible.
Well, it put stress on Rex, for one thing, and here's somebody who just didn't expect to have to do it. He's all Fletcher has, and there's not as much money as he thought he was going to have, and it just puts a lot of stress on that relationship, on the family, and he wants to do right by Fletcher, and yet it's a difficult situation, and believe me, my mother is suffering, not from Alzheimer's, but from dementia, the kind of dementia, and it's just extraordinarily difficult. And when you see somebody who, is still herself, and you've written a wonderful book about this subject, and it just, you know, because that is the person. It is the person.
Yeah.
It is who they are, and you still have a relationship with them, and the whole. It's not a it doesn't just like all, everything goes all at once. So
no, it doesn't.
Yeah, it just is, it's a very difficult disease, and so that puts the stress on Rex. And it also puts stress on Jolie Romero, who has had a relationship with Fletcher and Ophelia for years. And maybe, you know, we wonder, is she wishing a little bit in love with Fletcher? Fletcher was a notorious rake, you know, as we used to say. I love that word.
I love
rake.
Characters like that.
But anyway, he was, you know, he was a philanderer. And did they have an affair? What's the impact of his illness now on her? What was the impact on Verity and Graham Blackwood, who also had a relationship with him? Because we find out that Fletcher and Ophelia, and therefore Rex, had a place in Oxford, England, near where the Blackwoods live. They have a place in Oxford too, and so there's a tie there. And then how does that tie into our missing prosecutor? So it's another piece of the puzzle, something else that's going on. And Graham, we find out, stayed behind in Boston. So his wife is in London, hovering between life and death due to an opioid overdose, and he stayed behind in Boston. So why did he stay behind? And where did she get the opioids? How did she end up taking them? Was it an accident? Was she trying to commit suicide? Was it on purpose? Or did somebody slip them to her?
Well, whatever it is, I can advise people, you don't want to take them, ever.
Yeah, if you know.
It's scary. I mean, seriously scary. I know people that I interviewed somebody a couple of weeks ago, and her son died of an overdose, and they didn't stop him. And she had an operation, and she said, well, I have Percocet, Vicodin, Oxycodone, morphine. I said, your son died of an overdose. Why would you even take that? Ever? I was like surprised. I go, excuse me? Oh, my God. So this is my other two favorite characters. My other favorite character, the art thief. I love Oliver York. I mean, really. He's never going to go straight, but who cares? Seriously.
MI5 has him by the short hairs, so he's going he's making amends for you. He was a serial art thief for a decade. And he's an English, wealthy English guy, but he has this very tragic past where he witnessed his parents' murders when he was 8 years old.
I love him. He's my favorite person besides Wendell. And how did he come into the mix with Henrietta? And she's really not who we think she is. And what happens? How did they come to this whole situation with Verity and about questioning her? Because I'm so glad you brought
Henrietta and Oliver are an interesting pair. And we meet Henrietta.
Yeah.
And even though you can dive into the imposter's lure, trust me, and figure out all of this, the background is all there. But Henrietta plays a central role in the previous book in the series, Thief Smart. And she and Oliver grew up together in the Cotswolds. And she became an MI5 officer, and he became an art thief. And they worked together and at odds with each other in Thief's Mark to get answers to what happened to him as an 8-year-old when his parents were murdered in front of him, and then the murderers kidnapped him to Scotland, and then he escaped, and the two have not been caught. And so in Thief's Mark, we learn a lot about that. But Henrietta, they've known each other since they were tots. She didn't grow up in the in that little village in the Cotswolds. She had a great aunt who was there, and her parents would drop her off for weeks at a time to hang out there. So now she flirts with the idea of not being with MI5 anymore and instead being a garden designer, taking after her great aunt Posy. And so she's kind of an eccentric character, but by the time we're in Imposter's Lure, she still is with MI5. Oliver is a he's helping MI5 with his knowledge of all the different things that he's learned. Both that he's a self-taught mythologist and an art thief. And so during that time, he met a lot of people, learned a lot of things. And so he's kind of making amends. He returned all the art it's stolen. It's all back with its owners intact. But he so he's making amends by helping MI5. And they are actually at the hotel where Verity has her overdose. Mm-hmm. And it's Wendell Sharp who's gotten them there. When Verity was in touch with Wendell, this is Emma's grandfather, the private art detective, and Verity wanted to talk to him about something. And they go up, and they're the ones who find her near death from the overdose and get her to the hospital, and then she's, to see if she'll recover. So that's how they get involved in this because of their relationship with Wendell Sharp. And Oliver Wendell, so if we go back a few books, Wendell Sharp was chasing this unknown art thief for 10 years, and that turns out to be Oliver. And they've actually become kind of friendly with each other because, you know, who's Wendell to hold a grudge?
Tell us about Sam. How did he get involved in this one, too?
Oh, Sam Padgett?
Yeah, I like him too.
Oh yeah, he's I love this character. Sam is relative newcomer to the Emma and Colin's team, this hit. And by the way, Colin is sort of a member but sort of not a member. Emma really is a full on, but Colin does these undercover missions that aren't necessarily part of HIT. But Sam comes on, and he's like this. He's a Texan, and he worked in Texas, and now he's come up to Boston to be part of HIT. And he's not sure, he doesn't like the cold weather that much, but he's very dedicated to his work and just kind of a. I don't know. He has a great sense of humor, very wry sense of humor. And he and Emma get along really well. And he's a part of this investigation into what's happened to the prosecutor, because the stakes grow as the story, as imposters were progresses. You know, we find out, yeah, okay, she didn't just go off on vacation, and oh my gosh, we have a death, we have an opioid overdose, we have what's going on here. And then there's other things, and there's all these different pieces of the puzzle that they have to put together, and we have the ticking clock, because is Tamara, is she in danger? You know, is she still alive? How can we get to her? What's going on?
Well, it wasn't so easy to figure out where a missing person is. And you need the right people to figure it out, because this is not easy. I mean, she just didn't appear out of nowhere. So, who is
Stephen, exactly.
And why is his death considered a murder? And why is he linked to Verity and Graham? So a lot of people that are linked to these things.
Yes, and I think this what happens as they're investigating, is Emma and Colin and Hit are investigating and trying to figure out what happened to Tamara McDermott. They learn about the various people that she has been in touch with and then who they've been in touch with. So it's like ripple effects. And one of them is Stefan, who is a guy in England who has died. And he turns out to have had a relationship with the Blackwoods, with the Campbells. And, okay, so he was killed. He was shot to death. So how does that tie in then with the missing prosecutor? So it's as Emma and Colin ask questions, and Henrietta and Oliver in England ask questions, because they're involved now too. So they go to the Blackwood home in Oxford because they've got Verity recovering or maybe not recovering from this opioid overdose, and they have Graham in Boston and what's happened to him, and they're trying to figure out what's going on here. And they learn about, like, okay, this guy just died, was a friend of theirs, was shot. How did this happen? Does this relate to all of this, or is it something completely random and separate?
Well, we're not going to tell them, but before I forget, Tuesday, someone you know too, Bruce Coffin, will be here. I'm doing the launching of his book, Beyond the Truth. I am so excited. I've never done that before on the first day that a book comes out. This is so cool.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that is awesome. And on the first, I actually walked up to James Heyman during the PhilaFest and said, how come I never read your books? You're sitting right there. How come you don't know me? He said, I know, you're always going to trip you before. So he's coming on for the second time with Fatal Obsession. Oh, my God, this is so good, on November 1st. On the 5th of November, A Scar Tissue, Patricia Hale. And then one of my other favorite people that you love and adore, Manuscript for Murder, the Jessica Fletcher series with John Land, who's writing it now.
Oh, yeah.
On the 12th, this is sad, the guy's name is I Am Waiting. That's not his name, but that's the author's name. The book is called In My Mother's Honor. He's a 70-some-odd-year-old man who never got his VA benefits, and I'm doing it on Veterans Day to bring it out.
Oh,
on the,
okay.
Yeah, scary. On the 14th, we have Tess Gerritsen. I hope I have to check with her. Island Zero was her new scary movie. She wants to talk about it. And on the 11/20, someone else you know and love, one of my favorite people in the whole universe, Vincent Zandri, Flower Man. And after the Thanksgiving, on the 26th, Network Exposed. And on the 28th, a 9/11 survivor, Artie Van Wy, will talk about 17 years of not being able to deal with a 9/11. And that's just some of what I'm up to. And, of course, let me remind everybody, on the 10th, Carl is going to be back again with a whole bunch of people, and we're going to talk about how you pick the names of your characters, how you pick the setting, and a whole bunch more questions that I'll send everybody very soon. So this is a very important question. How come Oliver calls Finian, and why is Finian not realized that maybe he shouldn't be a priest and deal out with AF? So how come he called him? That's funny. I'm so glad you brought him in because I love that character.
Well, Oliver and Finian do actually have a relationship. Oliver has been in Rock Point. Oh, let me say who Finian is, of course. He's an Irish priest who he too has a tragic background, and in a way that's why Finian and he and Oliver get along and have an understanding that perhaps other people might not have. And because Finian lost his, he wasn't always a priest. He was married and had two young daughters, and he started a whiskey distillery in the Kerry Hills in Ireland with his twin brother Declan. And life was just wonderful. Everything was going great until his wife and daughters were in a sailing accident and drowned. And that just plucked Finian off the path he was on and threw him into despair and into a whole nother path. And he ended up becoming a priest. And he is serving a church in Maine, in Colin's hometown, where the Donovans are. And it's a struggling little church, and he's supposed to be there just for a year while the longtime priest is on sabbatical. But he ends up staying, but during that time he's there, he becomes friends with Colin and Emma and the Donovans and the Sharps, and he's just like kind of always involved in things. He's in every book in the series from the original one, Saint's Gate, to Imposter's Lore, and he and Oliver have met and kind of bonded, and so it's a natural thing for Oliver to get in touch with Finian.
Well, what happens when Emma finds Graham, and how does she find it that she has to question his sister Cecilia? How does she handle that? Because that's not easy, either.
Yeah, well, Graham Blackwood, as we know, has stayed in Boston while his wife Verity went back to London and ends up in overdosed. And so Graham, we find out, was one of the last people to see Tamara before she disappeared. Because that's one of the things when you when you're dealing with a missing person is you work backwards and you try to find, okay, who saw them last? And so Emma and Colin track him to her home, to Heron's Cove, Maine, where Sharp Fine Art Recovery is. And it ends up, you know, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler, but Graham was killed. So they end up finding his body. And Sister Cecilia is, backtrack just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The Blackwoods rented a house in Heron. That is immediately provocative for Emma and Colin as to why would they have done that. So they go to the house, nobody's there. And it happens to be right near the Sisters of the Joyful Heart convent. And Sister Cecilia is a young nun who has befriended Emma and teaches her watercolor painting. So Emma goes just to see. She has no concept that they were witnesses to anything nefarious, but just goes to talk to her to see if she has seen Blackwood, because they don't know where he is, Grant Blackwood. And it turns out that Sister Cecilia did see something, did hear something, and they end up finding the body.
Oh my God, that's I always wonder what a police officer really feels when he sees something like that, and they actually have to see a body that's out of nowhere. That must be really scary. And out of nowhere, did you just see? Yeah. That would be scary.
Definitely.
Especially
definitely.
For the
and here we have Sister Cecilia, who's young, and she's an art educator, and just has no, you know, just this is not what she's expecting. And yet we meet her in Saints Gate. That's that first book in the series. And she has a very difficult experience there. So this stirs things up for her. And that's something that happens throughout Imposter's Lore, is these different things that happen to people, these different pieces of the puzzle and the action stirs up stuff.
Well, just when you think nothing's going to happen, the fun part is something's going to happen. It's like the unexpected constant. Like, yeah, I know. It's like, oh, my God, now what's going to happen to all these people? Okay, so Adelaide is not close with her father, Patrick, right? But what happens that shows that maybe he's not so terrible after all? And she has to connect with him because he doesn't know that what's happened to the mother.
Yeah, their relationship is, I'm not sure exactly which scene you're referring to, but their relationship is she has had a troubled relationship with both her parents. They're both, they're both more ambitious and driven than she is. They're lawyers, and she's going into art, document preservation. So it's a different situation, different sensibilities, that's the word I'm looking for. And her father, it's like, does he even care that his ex-wife is missing, and he had an affair, and how Adam feels about that? It's all very, you know, it's a lot for her to wrap her head around, where her childhood and all her expectations of what her life would be like were changed when her parents split up.
That's hard on anybody, any children.
Sure.
And sometimes parents don't even realize that they're affected or anything. So.
Yeah, I think it's easy for certain. Depends on the personality type, but certainly for the McDermotts, that they were, they just had so much on their own minds, and their daughter was, you know, she was fine. She was doing really well. She was going on to college. She was. You know, so they didn't really think too much about her. They were thinking about their own situations, and they both had, you know, professional lives that needed attention, and so it was very. And sometimes I think, you know, well, in Adeline's case, she didn't want to let them see her sweat. So she did. She maybe hid some of her own pain from her parents.
A lot of kids do, unfortunately.
Sure.
I know, after teaching for 1,000 years, you know when a child comes in, oh, my parents are getting divorced, and you have to get the guidance counselor to talk about it. Sometimes they just want to talk about it to you. And it's sad because sometimes you get a child that's an A-plus student, and all of a sudden you're wondering, like, you didn't do your homework, you didn't study. And instead of yelling and go, okay, what's the matter, what happened? A lot of people don't realize that. And the people need to be more perceptive and more astute with everybody. So we have about 15 more minutes. So Tamara, you know she's in trouble. How do we know that she's resourceful and doesn't give up on herself? She's pretty clever. I got to tell you, that was pretty good. When she's in big trouble here, and all of a sudden she's able to cope with her situation. How does she do that? I mean, most people would just go stir crazy.
One of the things I decided to do in Imposter's Lure that I don't always do, but it really fit this story, was to go into her point of view. So she doesn't know where she is, but the reader, therefore, has more information about her situation than Emma and Colin, Sam, any of the people who are trying to figure out where she is and what she's up to.
Mm-hmm.
So the reader knows, she's in distress. She's in trouble. But she knows she's in trouble. And we see her, getting snatched. We don't know who did it, why. And then she's held in this nasty little bathroom in a cellar. And she knows this. And she can see and feel around and try to figure out, okay, what am I going to do here? And the way, it's just like, I think it's some of it's like, a natural thing to try to figure out for somebody. Or you could just, some other people might just like curl up in a ball and close their eyes and pretend it's not, nothing's going on. But she is, she is resourceful. And so if you think about it with her relationship with her daughter, that some of the things that frustrate her daughter about her mother are actually things that help her mother survive her experience.
I don't know how many people could do what she did and to be sane when they came out. My God, that's if they find her. So another thing that made me brought the tissues out was is Timothy. And Emma didn't realize it. How come they didn't realize that he was on opiates? Or if they did, that was sad.
Well,
that was bad.
I think he's. I would say he had been prescribed opiates.
Yeah.
And he's during Imposter's Lure, he's actually not taking them. But, he's got some in the cabinet because he suffers from chronic pain after a fall. And there's a lot of, how you do pain management. That's something that's certainly in my family, and there's just different approaches depending on the kind of pain, where the pain is, and what's causing it. And so for him, he injured his back, and just is in chronic pain. And there's they've tried different things, and he's still in pain. But he's now doing other techniques. There's just different things you can try, and different medical people have different approaches. So I would never tell somebody what they should do about their pain. This is about Timothy and what he is doing. And so he and his wife, and these are Emma's parents, have been in London for the past year and had it's just kind of like a change of scenery as a way of managing their situation, because he was going to take over for Wendell, or partner with Wendell and run the offices in Heron's Cove while Wendell, his father, is in Dublin. And instead he just can't do that. He does research for Sharp Fine Art Recovery, but it's his son, Lucas, who runs the firm. And so they come back. Faye and Timothy, Emma's and Lucas's parents, come back to Heron's Cove to their home there. Right before Imposter's Lure gets going, and Timothy takes these long walks, and And it's just easy for him to think that, okay, this woman has had an opioid overdose. She was in Heron's Cove. Is there any connection between hit medicine that he has but doesn't touch versus with, does that have anything to do with what happened to her and how she ended up overdosed? So there's just some questions that come in as to what's going on with him, and do the parents tell him everything about his medical situation? Those questions, they're just a thread. They're not a big part of Imposter's Lure, but they are they're important to how it all comes together and what happens with Emma and her relationship with her family and her work.
I love Emma. She's a lot like me. She doesn't stop until she finds the answers. And
she keeps going.
I get criticized sometimes when you want to know the answers to questions. Well, why do you keep asking? Well, if you'd give me the answer to start with, I wouldn't bug you.
And Emma is very analytical, yeah. And she takes things step by step. And then Colin he's worked undercover, so he's trained and has a lot of experience to when to trust his instincts and his gut, and so they do make a really interesting pair, but romantically, you know, as a couple, but also when in their work. And again, they don't work side by side, but in Imposter's Lure, they really do end up doing quite a bit side by side because Tamara is Yank's friend.
So, how and why did they learn more about the Fletches? Now, this is interesting because this is probably, you know, even true in real life. A painter dies and their paintings are worth more money when he's gone because he can't paint anymore. And what's there is, this was kind of interesting. I said, oh, so Fletcher is dead, so now his paintings are going to be more money if he dies? Would that happen?
Well, yes, that can happen. It doesn't always happen, but it's supply and demand. If this is, and he's already a well-known, well-respected artist who commanded a lot for his painting, but he's also had a very very affluent, very spendthrift kind of lifestyle. So he's basically spent every penny that he makes. But they have a place in southern New Hampshire, and they had the place in Oxford, and they spend winters in different, you know, so they really have had quite the lifestyle, and Rex was a part of that. And now Fletcher has Alzheimer's and isn't expected to live much longer. And so what will that do to the value of his paintings? And then what if, you know, so what if somebody bought a painting for a less amount of money and then it becomes more? Or then we get into, well, what if somebody's copying his paintings or pretending to be forging his paintings, and what would that do to the value? If suddenly people start, who own the paintings, wonder, well, is this a real one or is this a fake one, and how can I find out, or can I ever know? Will that erode the value of his work, or there any inventory? Because one of the things we learn in Imposter's Lure is that at the farm in southern New Hampshire, the quote-unquote farm, you know, where the Campbells live, that's their main residence, and then they live in different places, different times of the year and whatnot, but that's their home, and that's where Fletcher's had his painting studio in the barn, and the barn has burned. And with it went some of his inventory of paintings, as well as some pieces that he owned. And that is where, that's how Jolie gets involved. I mean, she's known them for a while, but that's in terms of the story, she's going through and trying to see what she can preserve of these paintings, that, if anything. Because it's like if it's smoke damage or if it's burn and see what she can rescue and how that affects the value. So there's a lot going on with the Campbells.
Well, before we end, we have about 4 minutes. Are you going to bring Adelaine back?
I hadn't thought of it, but it would be easy enough since she is in Boston, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she is a preservationist.
Yeah.
One never knows.
I was thinking. I know. So it says, family bonds are tested in the story. Emma learns some harsh realities, too. Friendship, love, loyalty, hope, despair, and deceit are all issues that, and just some, and trust, and you incorporated all of them. So what's next for Emma and Colin and the hit team? No, you can't kill them off at all. And where do can we find, that's it. And where can you find out more about your work? And, of course, we're going to remind everybody she's never going to kill off Wendell because he's going to live to be 170. Seriously.
Absolutely. Wendell is untouchable. But I'm writing Rivals Break. That's the next one in the Sharp and Donovan series, and I'm very excited about it. And you can find out all kinds of things about me on my website, carlaneggers.com, and I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and you can follow me on BookBub, which is a great site to stay in touch with all your favorite authors.
Oh, I have to start doing that, too. I mean, I get books in the mail. For those of you that want to know what to buy for Hanukkah and Christmas and Thanksgiving, buy a couple of copies of Imposter's Lore. I just finished a book, and as we're talking about Alzheimer's, I don't know how many people read the Book of M. My husband took it out of the library, and I found the publicist, and I said, oh, my God, what did I do? And they sent it to me. It's about what would happen if you lost your shadow. And your memories went, and you became a shadowless person. And after a while, like Alzheimer's, you start to forget everything. But in that particular case, your memories are never going to come back. And what happens between the people that are shadowed and shadowless reminds you of what happens in the wars and the uprisings in the news. It's scary. But it's probably one of the best books I read yesterday. All 400 pages. No, seriously. There are a lot of great books out there. I mean, but if you wanted to, you know, start with Carlin Eggers and start from the beginning, I think that would be a really good idea. And Book of M is another one. And I Am Waitings in My Mother's Honor is excellent. And Scar Tissue. And, of course, Beyond the Truth with Bruce Coffin on Tuesday. That should be interesting, and I'm excited. But I can't wait to get a pre-release copy of your new one. When is that coming out so I know? I have to put it in my schedule so I don't forget.
Let's see. Rivals Break will be out late September.
And you have anything else coming out in another series in between that I should know about?
I do. Stone Bridges.
Oh, good.
Comes out in the Swift River Valley series, and that's not suspense. It's just a fun series set in the Quabbin Reservoir area in Massachusetts. Lots of history and a small town and, you know, interesting women and interesting guys.
And when is that coming out?
Late March. Stone Bridges.
That's good. That is good, yeah. And I'm excited, and I want to thank you so much. And I'm glad you're having – it's warm there because here it's 42 degrees and going down.
Well,
we're going to get into Norisa tomorrow. Yeah, thanks a lot. Everybody, Carla, thank you so much. I hope I get to see you with the Thriller Fest this year. Maybe you'll come again?
Oh, I would love to see you. We'll see if we can make it work.
Oh, that would be great, because Larry Thompson emailed me, and this time he's going to come. I spoke to him last week.
Oh, great. I love Larry.
That
would be great.
Yeah, he was great. He had a knee replacement, so he, you know, didn't come. But he's going to come this year with Vicki, and I hope that we can all have a dinner at the Capitol Grill again. That would be so cool. So
that would be wonderful.
Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great day. The sun is shining. It may be cold, but the sun is shining, so who cares? Have a nice day, and bye.